True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Today was obviously a really huge day for you. Justice Jeffrey Nettle has sentenced Adrian Bailey to life, but with a 35-year non-parole period. Mm. What's your reaction to that? Do you think it's enough?
I don't think anything's enough. I can't think of a worse person than that man. And it wasn't. I wasn't expecting anything else. I wasn't expecting the judge to hand down life without parole, simply because people had told me this wouldn't happen. I certainly don't think the sentence for rape charge was enough at all. Given what this man has done in the past, I think that 15 years is a disgrace, considering the maximum penalty for rape is 25. And I don't know what the maximum penalty is for if it's not for that man. I don't know who else could fit the bill of the maximum sentence for rape.
Part of the reason why the judge said he gave the sentence that he did was because he said that Bailey expressed some degree of remorse. What did you think about that? I mean, did you think he was remorseful, and did you think that it mattered?
No. I don't see how he was remorseful. I see a man who continued to do the same thing over and over again that he considered remorseful. No, I don't think it matters at all. It would matter in maybe some cases, but not in the case of a serial offender, not in the case of somebody who keeps doing it over and over again. If he has a little cry, I mean, I don't know what difference that makes to sentencing at all. It's baffling, it's bewildering to sit there and listen to somebody sort of coddle this man with ideas of remorse, and, you know, who cares if he has remorse?
How did you feel when you found out that he had served two previous prison sentences for sexual assaults, multiple sexual assaults, threats to kill, abductions, the whole thing, and for the last sentence, he served less than half of the maximum penalty for 16 counts and 5 victims?
I feel furious, and I'm still furious. Whenever I hear anybody say it, whenever I mean it, my blood boils. It sends a disturbing message. This man is unrepentantly evil. It's obviously a complete menace, and it sends out a really dangerous message to society, I think, if you do this. I mean, I'm aware that his previous victims were sex workers, and I'll never be convinced that had nothing to do with the leniency of the sentence. What it says to women is, you know, be careful what you do, because if you don't like what you do, you won't get justice. And then what it says to people like Bailey is, not don't rape, but be careful who you rape.
Do you think that the justice system failed your wife and yourself?
Yeah, absolutely, of course it did.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick. Now I'm going to apologize in advance for any problems with the sound quality of today's recording. As you probably know, we were on hiatus last week, and during that time, we moved to New Mexico. So here we are in our new home, but without our equipment, because it's still en route. So we've kind of jury-rigged some stuff, see how we do. So that's my disclaimer.
Yes, it's going to sound shitty, there's no doubt about it.
Well, I don't know that there's no doubt, but I don't think it's going to sound as good as it should.
Right, exactly.
All right.
Okay.
But here we go.
All right. 29-year-old Jill Maher was going about her daily life on September 22, 2012, when a man with a lengthy criminal record took it all away from her. That night, she'd gone out with some friends after work for drinks. On the short walk back to her apartment, she encountered serial rapist Adrian Bailey. CCTV would capture Bailey approaching Jill on the street at 1:40 a.m. She had her mobile phone in her hand. His face was obscured, but he was described by the blue hoodie that he was wearing. When Jill didn't make it home that night, her husband began to search for her, eventually contacting the police. She was officially a missing person at that point, but soon the awful truth would become clear. Jill had been brutally assaulted and murdered by a repeat offender out on parole. On top of the horror of Jill's rape and murder at the hands of Adrian Bailey, one other disturbing fact was exposed. The state's parole system was broken. How could a man found guilty of 20 rapes in a 23-year time span be allowed to roam the streets of Melbourne's suburbs after recently smashing the jaw of another man while he was already on parole? At the time of Jill's murder, Bailey was on parole after serving 8 years in jail for 16 counts of rape against 5 separate women. He had already served time before for rapes committed from the time he was just 18. It made the tragedy of Jill's murder even more senseless. At the Quiet End today, we're talking about a truly beautiful person whose life was taken by a man well known to be capable of violence. Jill spent her last day doing what many of us do, working in a job she loved, enjoying a few drinks in the company of friends, and making her way home on a well-traveled street just blocks from her home. So what went wrong? We're going to talk about that.
So you'd like to talk about a beer?
Yes, let's get a beer underway. Okay.
I think I finally got this Australian beer stuff correct. Melbourne's a city in the state of Victoria, so I've got that part figured out. And Brunswick, where a lot of this story takes place, is kind of a suburb or a town outside of Melbourne, correct?
I believe so.
So what I did for a beer, and this is courtesy of our wonderful Australian friends, this is Brunswick Bitter, which is brewed by Thunder Road Brewing Company in Brunswick, Australia. I think I got it. So this beer is a clear, pretty gold color. No head whatsoever, and I poured it pretty vigorously. Nothing much happened. Faint aroma of sweet malt, a little bit of hops. Not much for the aroma. And the taste is also a little bit lacking. Kind of a biscuity taste. A little hint of hops towards the end. So this beer is only 4.9%, so it's one of these beers you can be drinking more than one of, and it's certainly a nice, crisp, refreshing beer. It just doesn't have that much taste to it. But overall, not bad.
Okay, thanks, Dick. Let's open it up.
Okay.
Now, not much happening at the Quiet End. Of course, we did tell you we relocated. So we got a little bit different vibe here. We don't have the New England vibe. We've got the West, Southwest vibe here.
We sure do. And there's people speaking Spanish in this place.
Yes, which we need to work on.
We certainly do.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's a beautiful day.
It is.
Sunny.
Another one of those perfect days, sunny and 100.
I know, right? So sometimes we might have to have the Quiet End on the deck. Maybe we'll think about that.
Yeah, we'll see.
We'll see what's going on there.
Okay.
All right, why don't you start out our story today?
So Jill spent her later life in Australia, but she had been born on the east coast of Ireland in 1982. She was the eldest of Edith and George McKeon's two children. Jill had a brother named Michael, and he was 3 years younger. Jill's childhood was quiet and peaceful, living in the close-knit Tomunfeckin village north of Drogheda. But this is about 50 kilometers north of Dublin. And Jill was just a happy, lovable person. She was known to be quite messy and kind of clumsy. Her mother would later describe her as both gorgeous and goofy. She would fall over piles of clothes that she had stacked in her bedroom. And Michael would remember her falling downstairs on more than one occasion. Now, in 1990, her childhood changed. So she's 8 years old then. Father had taken an accounting position in Western Australia. So they made the move, and she thrived in her new environment. Throughout her school years, Jill became very creative and developed an expansive sense of humor. She wrote children's stories for her cousins back in Ireland, which they really enjoyed. So she continued her schooling back in Ireland at St. Oliver's and at a small community college.
Yeah, so she went back. So the college yearbook from Jill's graduation year showed a photo of her. She was a pretty teen in a school uniform with her tie slightly off-center. She was known to dress in a rush, often leaving things to the last minute. But she was undeniably attractive. She had the type of dark hair and creamy white skin often attributed to Snow White. Her wide, white smile showed that she had a true joy for life. At age 19, Jill went to the University College in Dublin and spent the next 3 years studying English, sociology, and psychology. She continued to write stories in her spare time, and she acted in some university plays. Financially, she did support herself by working at the Student Union Bar. As a very sociable woman, Jill loved music, parties, dancing, and singing. She loved to make people laugh. She also liked to shop and developed a taste for bright colors and high heels, often red or bright pink. She had a really big personality, whether she was convincing new friends to dance on a night out or if she was staying in and crying over a sentimental TV show.
Now, while she was at university, Jill met her future husband, Tom Marr. Both Tom and Jill had recently left relationships, but they formed an instant bond with each other. They dated a few times and very quickly became exclusive. So Tom appreciated Jill's intelligence and her quirky sense of humor. They were married in July 2008 at St. Peter's Church, the same church where Jill had been baptized as an infant.
So the couple moved permanently to Melbourne in 2009. They really loved the warmer climate, and they said they liked the lifestyle there. And also Jill's parents had recently moved back to Australia, although they were on the other side of the continent, I think in Perth, maybe? Was it Perth?
I think I remember Perth.
Yep. In 2011, Tom and Jill moved from the South Bank area to the inner city suburb of Brunswick. Brunswick was considered multicultural, and it had recently had a number of residential buildings added. It was kind of catering to the growing number of young professionals moving into the area.
They're yuppifying it, huh?
Right. So the main feature there was Sydney Road, which was this huge strip of shops, small businesses, restaurants, pubs, and it had many trendy bars and coffee shops. So really for these young working professionals. The Mars lived one block away from Sydney Road in a modern apartment at a large complex in Lux Way. Now, the main mode of getting around in that area was on foot, and this is how Jill and Tom socialized in their neighborhood. Many of the best places in town were just in a short walking distance of their apartment. The people in Brunswick considered their neighborhood to be pretty safe. In the years leading up to Jill's murder, the last well-known serious crime was back in 2004, when the patriarch of a family involved in organized crime was publicly gunned down in the Brunswick Club. Now, after Jill's death, residents would learn that their community was far less safe than they thought. There are people in the community that they had no idea they were, you know, around all the time.
Yeah. This, to me, this is kind of a scary thought.
It's very scary.
As you'll see when we get to the point.
Mm-hmm.
But it really is. And I think some of that is just because I'm so used to how things work in the United States, and I have little comprehension of what foreign countries do.
Right. Well, and we've heard that Australia has been known for being quite liberal and easy on crime.
Yes.
We've seen that in other cases.
Certainly easy on crime from a United States point of view.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, in March 2012, after 4 years of marriage, Jill and Tom hit a rough patch. They were both starting new jobs, and things were quite tense between them. They actually separated for a few weeks, but then Tom moved back in with Jill in June 2012. Jill told friends that the short break had been good for their relationship. Being apart had helped them realize how much they loved each other. They missed each other, and the relationship seemed stronger than ever. Strong enough that they began to talk about buying a house and eventually having a child.
Yeah, which wasn't always in the picture. They weren't sure that that was something they would do.
Right. So Jill began working as an administration professional, coordinating local radio shows with the Australia Broadcasting Corporation, ABC, in January 2012. The station she joined was a large but close-knit group of broadcasters, producers, technicians, and journalists. Now, Jill quickly became the go-to person whenever someone needed something. She was a person who brought positivity to meetings and acted as a competent professional. She was popular with all of her co-workers, and she never forgot a birthday. She loved to join in on all the celebrations. An independent, thoughtful, witty woman.
Now, in the month before Jill's death, she spent a lot of time traveling. She took 3 weeks off from work, and she and Tom went back to Ireland for a wedding. They visited her grandmother's house, where she was able to spend some time with her uncle, Michael McKeon, and her three cousins. Her cousins were young women, and they loved to hear about her career and her life in Brunswick. A picture was taken of these four young women smiling with their arms around one another, and that photo would end up becoming a treasured family keepsake. On September 1st, Jill's brother Michael called her with news that their father had had a stroke, and Jill made the trip to see him in Perth and stayed with him for a week as he recovered. Before she returned home that time, they made plans for him to visit her and Tom in Melbourne when his health improved. But this was sadly the last time the family would all be together, and Jill went ahead and returned to work in mid-September. Now this brings us up to just a few days before Jill was attacked. So at this point, I think we should go over the background of her killer, Adrian Bailey. And this is a guy who really had no business being out on the streets at all.
Not at all.
It's just frustrating to think
about. Not with his history.
No. So Bailey was born in 1971. He grew up in Melbourne. He was the oldest of five children. From a young age, he learned how not to take responsibility for his behavior. He was someone who always had an excuse. Nothing was ever his fault. And as an adult, he would claim that he had been sexually abused as a child. But this is only his account of things, so we really don't have any way of knowing if that's true.
Whatever the reasons, either inborn or environmental, Bailey didn't develop normally. He showed disturbing tendencies from a young age, with extreme mood swings and poorly controlled anger. Bailey associated sex with violence, power, and cruelty. So he left his home and his schooling in his teens. He did become a teenage father, but never developed stability in any of his relationships. He would move from woman to woman, job to job, and his life was punctuated with stints in prison. Now, when he was 18, he did marry his pregnant girlfriend, but by the time the child was born, he had already been in prison and released from prison.
Well, his first recorded sexual assaults occurred in 1990 when he was only 18. He'd been married for less than 2 months. While his wife was at work, Bailey supposedly organized a surprise party for her with the help of a 16-year-old friend of his sister. But this turned out to be a hoax. He used the opportunity to hold this 16-year-old hostage in the house. Then he attacked her and raped her. When charged with the offenses 2 days later, he denied everything in a taped police interview. Instead of being locked up immediately, he was released on bail pending his trial. So this was a part of the justice system that he would repeatedly benefit from in his entire life of crime. And he also had no regard for the rules of bail. After his release, he attacked again. That same year, he grabbed and assaulted a 17-year-old girl who was walking home from a bus stop. He ripped off her clothing, poked her in the eyes with his fingers, and grabbed her breasts and her genitals. He attempted to rape her, making some very graphic threats to kill her as well. He also told her that he would not leave any evidence for her to go to the police with. So really cruel.
Yeah, and the amazing thing to me is this happened just days after he's released from the first rape. So threats were always part of each of Bailey's attacks. After every rape and sexual assault, he would try to frighten all of his victims by convincing them that he would return to kill them if they reported these attacks. So in addition to the pleasure it gave him to terrorize women, these same threats made it less likely that his victims would go to the police. However, in September 1990, Bailey's second known victim identified him. Now again, he made the same denials when he was interviewed by the police, and again, he was charged with attempted rape and making threats to kill, and again, he was released on bail.
Which is outrageous. To me, it's unbelievable that he was released again.
I mean, I can see the first time, right?
Yeah, if it's his first offense.
If it's his first offense. And we don't even know that. It's his first known offense.
Right, right. Because we don't know what happened as a minor.
Right. But after the second one,
in a short period of time.
Very short period of time. He throws his ass in jail.
They didn't?
No, they let him go again.
And this isn't the worst of it, Dick. It gets worse. So 2 months after the birth of his child, Bailey had picked up a 16-year-old hitchhiker. She expected to be driven to the country town of Hillsville, but Bailey detoured to a remote area and attacked her, trying to force her to perform oral sex on him. Luckily, she was able to escape, and she did go to the police, and she had a very accurate description of him. When he was arrested this time, Bailey steadfastly denied everything. He even produced a bogus alibi. Now, he's still only 18 at this point, but he already showed some extreme cruelty and very devious behavior for someone so young. He was confronted with the evidence against him, and he eventually did make confessions to all three assaults. Although he never really took full responsibility, there was always a reason for it in his mind. An excuse, you know?
Yes.
So it was also pretty crazy that his wife stood by him.
Yeah, in July 1991, he was sentenced for all three of these brutal sex offenses, all having been committed within a 6-month time frame. The charges included one charge of rape, two of attempted rape, one of detaining a person against her will for sexual penetration, one for threatening to kill, and one for assault with intent to rape. Now, he was sentenced for these crimes to 5 years in jail with a minimum non-parole period of 3 years. So you figure, okay, I mean, to me, again, as a United States citizen, that's pretty easy.
Yeah.
But that's the sentence. So,
but it's even worse, right? Because he only ended up serving what?
He didn't serve quite 2 years.
Yeah.
So what's this minimum period of non-parole for 3 years? They just kind of ignored that.
I don't know how that gets changed. But there are a lot of changes get made in a lot of these sentences get shortened.
Yeah. So he showed remorse. He conned his way through rehab. And he got out of jail in April of 1993. But by 1995, his wife had left him.
Now, finally.
That's another bit of oddity.
Well, I mean, she was very young.
Yeah, but geez.
And who knows what she knew.
Your husband's been convicted of three rapes or convicted of assaulting three women?
Well, I'm sure she, for a while she was on his side thinking he was innocent. That's how that works.
Yeah, but he confessed.
He did.
All right, well, I know we're starting to get into the nitty-gritty, but first, why don't we take a break for our sponsors?
Yeah, let's get that done. So this episode is sponsored by one of my favorite beauty products I've talked about before, and that's Madison Reed Hair Color. Madison Reed is a company founded by a woman and a mother. I love that. Her name is Amy Arrett, and she named her company after her daughter. The way she's managed to bring together salon quality and affordability to give women beautiful, multi-dimensional hair color at home is really revolutionizing the way that women are coloring their hair. When I was younger, I had no money, and my choices were to stop being a blonde, to overextend my credit card with a trip to the salon, or to use the unpredictable, cheap, kind of crappy boxed hair color that you could get at the drugstore or the supermarket. And none of these choices made me happy. But when you use Madison Reed, you're going to look like you just walked out of a salon. It's convenient at-home hair color with an ammonia-free salon-quality formula. You can experience beautiful hair color without breaking the bank or even leaving your house. How cool is that? Madison Reed is made in Italy, and they deliver it right to your door, all for under $25. You can find your perfect shade at madison-reed.com. Madison Reed is honoring our True Crime Brewery listeners with 10% off, plus free shipping on their first color kit. Just use promo code BREWERY. That code again is BREWERY, BREWERY.
This episode is also sponsored by Sunbasket. We've enjoyed many Sunbasket meals and have never, ever been disappointed. Sunbasket delivers delicious meal kits right to your door, making healthy cooking easy and convenient for any busy lifestyle. The meals have a fancy gourmet appearance, but they're actually pretty easy and convenient, so you can cook healthy, delicious meals at home, no matter how much or how little experience you might have in the kitchen. Sunbasket has 18 healthy options to choose from every week, including paleo, gluten-free, lean and clean, and my personal favorite, vegan. So Sunbasket works with the best farms and suppliers to bring you fresh, organic produce, and each recipe features organic produce and clean ingredients. The best part is you get a delicious meal that is quick and easy. With Sun Basket, everything's delivered with 30-minute recipes ready to whip up any time. No grocery shopping required.
Well, that's the best part. You know, we do Sun Basket at least 1 week every month. And this week was our Sun Basket week because we've been traveling and we haven't had time to shop and do all that. So Dick took charge this time and he created their Mediterranean chickpea salad with pistachios and a golden raisin vinaigrette. The beans and nuts made it very hearty and filling, so it's so much more than a salad. And it was really delicious.
It certainly was. And I like how they combine these ingredients, because I'm maybe lacking a little in imagination, but I would never have figured out to put pistachios in this recipe.
No, and we love pistachios.
And we do love pistachios. But it just, you know, you got the chickpeas and you got the crunchy pistachios and the vinaigrette that was sweet, raisiny, just excellent.
And it surprised me because I am a girl who does not like raisins in things. I like raisins on their own, but if you put them in a muffin or bread, I'm not into that. But this vinaigrette was delicious. I liked it.
Me too.
So go to sunbasket.com/brewery today to learn more and get $35 off your first order. That's sunbasket.com/brewery for $35 off. sunbasket.com/brewery. Thank you, Sunbasket.
Thanks. We'll have some more of you.
Yes.
From 1995, when his wife left him, until 1998, Bailey was quite peripatetic. He fathered two more children with another woman in 1998 and 2001, and he completed an apprenticeship as a pastry cook. And he got a job in a bakery in Abbotsford. Now, he usually finished working around 9 o'clock in the evening, and he began to use his drive home from Abbotsford to North Dandenong to target sex workers in the Bayside Melbourne areas of Elwood and St. Kilda. Now, Bailey had no respect for women. We know that. We can tell from his actions.
Oh, no kidding.
But he was especially disdainful of prostitutes. These are women who are probably in the most vulnerable group in the community. But to Bailey, they were worthless, fair game, and the perfect targets for sadism and mental cruelty. So he would never be satisfied with their sexual service. He needed to rape and terrorize them.
Yeah, between September 2000 and March 2001, he picked up numerous women. He would pretend to negotiate a fee and drive into a lane where he would park the car with the passenger side right up against a fence and lock the door, so his victims had no way of escaping. They were truly trapped. And he did horrible things to these women. He raped at least three of them anally. One was injured so severely that she bled for weeks. And he really enjoyed their cries for help, and the more upset they became, the crueler he would become. He also inflicted mental anguish by threatening to kill them, and by showing a knife. He did terrible, degrading acts against these women that I'm not even going to go into. They're just disgusting. And he would laugh and promise to come back for them again, to kill them, and to dump their bodies in an alley. In his view of the world, sex workers were not only easy targets, but they were less likely to report his crimes to police. So not surprisingly, the sex workers didn't have all that much faith in the police to help them. Also, some officers wouldn't give high priority to assaults and rapes of sex workers. But there were a large number of victims who bravely did come forward and give statements. Detectives took statements from 16 women, but at least five of them were too afraid to go to court to testify against him. He was arrested in April of 2001. DNA samples linked him to the attacks.
So when he was interviewed by the police, Bailey gave his usual denials. But after he was confronted with the evidence, he did admit to his involvement. So in his kind of deranged way of thinking, he seemed to think that his behavior was justifiable on the grounds that he needed to fulfill his sexual needs with sex workers because he couldn't inflict the acts on his partner. Now, that's a pretty convoluted way of thinking.
Well, his whole way of thinking is deranged, yeah. He would explain that he didn't see it as rape because he wasn't getting the sex he needed at home. It was all the fault of his missus, as he would call the women he was with. So his partner, who he called his missus, even though they were never married, was also a victim of domestic violence at his hands, it turns out. So she stood beside him for a long time. And that's what happens, right?
Exactly.
The battered woman syndrome. I don't know if they still call it that, but there's probably a more politically correct name for it now.
But they keep denying.
Right,
This stuff's going on.
Yeah, well, I mean, their whole way of thinking is messed up by living with this person and listening to them.
Yeah.
And being abused by them.
That's just living with them is the start of the problems.
Exactly. But he had seemed to maintain an apparently normal life while going out and brutally assaulting women. And his father wasn't totally convinced about that, though, because he told police he thought something was strange because Bailey would finish up at work at 9 p.m., and never got home until around 1 a.m. So he kind of knew he was up to something, although he would say he didn't know what exactly.
So Bailey was charged with 43 charges of rape, false imprisonment, making threats to kill, and recklessly causing injury. Despite this, he was granted bail of $5,000. Now eventually he did plead guilty, but only 5 victims ultimately came to court. So the charges were whittled down to a still huge 16 counts of rape against 5 women.
Yeah, and he admitted in his court hearing on these charges that he had simply gone through the motions while he had attended a sex offender rehab in his last stint in prison. A psychologist's report suggested that he may have borderline and antisocial personality traits. And at sentencing, the judge stated that an attempt must be made to protect society from Bailey. Back in 1992, the maximum sentence for rape in Victoria had been raised to 25 years, but not even the most depraved offenders had received this sentence. Many saw this as a real opportunity then to give a very violent repeat offender, Bailey, the maximum sentence and make a public statement about how the justice system sees violence against women as a real priority. But that didn't happen.
No, it didn't. He was sentenced to 11 years in prison, with a non-parole period of 8 years. So looking at this in realistic terms, his sentence equated to less than 1 year in prison for each rape. And this makes me wonder, if Bailey didn't deserve the maximum sentence, who would?
It's really hard to fathom.
Look at this.
Mm-hmm.
So his latest attacks involved 16 rapes and extreme sadism that showed very much a hatred for women. His previous record also included sex offenses against 3 teenage victims. Now, he had been imprisoned before, and he showed no sign of rehabilitation.
Well, the non-parole time period was less than 1/3 of the maximum sentence, and that was all he would be required to serve, was 8 years. So what do we think Bailey would learn from this sentence? I think he'd learn that these types of crimes really aren't serious. Maybe that society accepts a certain amount of sexual violence against women, especially sex workers.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I mean, despite what people say, I think sex workers are at the lower end of the ladder here.
Well, we see that in cases time and again. I mean, look at the Green River Killer, how many women he killed. And, you know, the thing is, a lot of these women had run away, so their family wasn't looking for them.
Yeah.
And priority was just not given to them.
Now, I would wager if he raped the Prime Minister's wife, the sentence would have been a little stiffer.
I think you're right.
So although the judge said if Bailey were granted parole, he should remain the subject of stringent supervision and restrictions, but he was still allowed the customary discount to his sentence because he did enter a guilty plea. So it didn't matter that he didn't plead guilty until he was faced with overwhelming evidence. He finally did plead.
Now, after his sentencing, a DNA saliva sample taken from him as part of the 2001 investigation was actually not retained on the Victorian or National DNA database. Also, when the Victoria Sex Offenders Register was brought into law in 2004, 2 years after that sentence, what the police could have done is they could have made a retroactive application to include him on that list, but they never did that. I guess it was just an oversight, but it seems like a big oversight.
Sure does.
His crimes weren't reported, and he was not known in the community as someone to look out for then. mentions that many of his victims were sex workers actually brought a lot of prejudice, as if being a prostitute linked them to being violently assaulted. Rape victims are often judged according to their appearance and activities before an attack, and we don't do that with other types of crimes. Now, of course, this is something we've talked about a lot.
We have.
Yes. And, of course, they shouldn't be judged by their appearance and activities.
Yeah, but in reality, that happens all the time.
It does. It really does. So it's really important, I think, for the law to look at it in a more judgment-free way and to look at everyone equally.
The law is supposed to be applied equally.
Right.
And it's not.
No. So it was pretty easy then for Bailey to blend back into the community when he was released in March 2010.
So he did serve his 8 years.
Yeah, he did. I don't think that's very long.
No, it isn't. But no. I mean, the first sentencing, where the non-parole period of 3 years, he was out in less than two.
True.
So at least...
it was a little longer this time.
It was a little longer.
Yeah, true. But there was no DNA profile stored in his name, and he was subject to only the standard level of supervision, which I think was a big error. This standard was completely inadequate. Police weren't even informed of his release. So the police in the area and the sex workers weren't even warned that he was in the community.
They had no idea.
No. Now the concept of parole, let's talk about that. I mean, it's really that a prisoner is giving his word to be on good behavior in exchange for this early release from prison. And it's meant to be earned by a very select few, I believe.
Well, you have to go through a bunch of hurdles to be deemed eligible for parole.
In the United States.
In the U.S.
Yes. And a prisoner should need to be worthy of release to the community, I would think. I mean, in theory, the freedom of completing parole outside is meant to assist prisoners to reintegrate back into society. That was the whole point. But then if you break any of the conditions of parole, that means you should be returned to prison. But that didn't happen in this case.
No, it didn't.
Which I believe from many of the cases we've read about in the U.S., I mean, even something like drinking, owning a gun, violations of parole like that, where you don't even really have a victim per se, you go back to prison.
But there's a lot of reasons to violate parole.
What do you mean?
In the U.S. Like you said, it's not just committing the same crime again. There's a bunch of things that'll land your ass back in jail.
Yeah, and that wasn't the case with Bailey. Now, his parole wouldn't actually expire until March 2013, and he did begin reoffending immediately, and he was in court after committing a serious assault. So he had a new girlfriend in 2011. When that relationship ended, he started seeing another girl known as Loretta, who was a single mother of two. And she didn't initially know about his history, and he really won her over by giving attention to her children, meeting her mom, and talking about their future together. But then within months, he sexually assaulted her, and she left him.
But I take it did not report this?
As far as I know.
We don't
have, certainly wasn't brought to court on it.
We don't have any evidence of that.
No.
Then in August of 2011, Bailey savagely smashed the jaw of a man outside of a cafe. So this guy gets rushed to the hospital, unconscious, and Bailey fled the scene. But he was taken to court in February 2012 for this assault.
And this was, from what I read, it was out of nowhere, like he was passing by him and looked at him wrong or something.
An unprovoked attack.
And he just wailed on him, actually knocked him unconscious. So this is a violent guy.
He's a very violent guy.
Yeah.
Now, Bailey claimed he'd been too drunk to remember the assault, but the entire incident was on closed-circuit TV. So Bailey did what he's always done. He pleaded guilty, this time to recklessly causing serious injury. Now, at this point, he should have been returned to prison. But despite his guilty plea and the violence of the crime, he appealed the 3-month sentence he was given, and by doing this, he was released and let out on bail. And this is just, again, to an American citizen. Mind-boggling stuff.
Oh, I think to most people, Dick, not just American citizens. I think the people in Australia had no idea this is how it worked either.
Yeah.
Now, the parole board had inexplicably decided to await the result of the charges against him. And at this point, Bailey was loose in the community. And what I really think about here is that he knew that he would likely return to prison on that charge. It was on the video footage.
Oh, there's no question that he knows he's going back to prison.
Right. So this really scares me, and it really seems ominous because I see him at that point as a man with literally nothing left to lose. So why wouldn't he reoffend? It's like he would really go for it, you would think.
Yeah.
Which is what he did.
That's what he did.
Now, he did get a job and began working out, and he kind of bulked up. And he even had his own Facebook page with a grand total of 9 friends. He described his favorite activities as going to the gym, listening to music, seeing movies. And really sickening to me, he described himself as a Buddhist.
That's almost laughable.
It's totally laughable.
Jesus.
Now, by August 2012, he missed 4 appointments with his parole officer, which should have been enough for him to go back to prison for that. But nothing happened.
Nothing happened.
So this is an opportunity just 1 month before Jill's murder, when Bailey could have been put back behind bars easily. But he wasn't.
No, he wasn't. So Friday, September 21st, 2012, Jill Maher was finishing up the work week. So at around 5 o'clock, Jill met her friend and ABC work colleague, Sky Condon, at her desk, and they left together for a drink. So on CCTV, you can see the two women moving through the automatic exit doors. They walked to the Ludlow Formation bar, where they each got a pint of cider. Sky's boyfriend, Tyrone, arrived, and the three had a drink. And this is all well-documented stuff.
Yes, it is.
So Jill left around 7:40 to go to a birthday celebration for another co-worker. This get-together was at the Fad Gallery in the Chinatown region of Melbourne. On her way to the Fad Gallery, Jill saw her friend Ken Baird unlocking his bicycle. So she stopped and chatted with him for a few minutes before she continued walking and arrived at the birthday party around 8 o'clock. So after a few drinks with the party, Jill met up with 3 other friends, Tom Wright, Joel Church, and Mark Veer. 9:30, they took a taxi from the Fad Gallery to the Brunswick Green Bar on Sydney Road, which was just a short distance from Jill's apartment. So at 9:47, Jill sent a text message to her husband Tom, telling him she was at the nearby Brunswick Green and inviting him to join them.
You know, Tom had just ended his work week by having drinks with friends, and he'd arrived home around 6. So by the time Jill's text arrived, he was asleep on the couch and he missed it. But Jill also texted another friend who lived nearby and invited her to the bar, but that friend couldn't make it. Joel and Mark left Brunswick Green at midnight, and Jill and Tom Wright stayed there until closing time at 1 a.m. Then the two of them decided to have one last drink and walked further up Sydney Road to Bar Etiquette. Tom Wright was in a very celebratory mood because he'd just learned recently that his partner was expecting their second child. They chatted at a table in the beer garden, and Jill told Tom that she would be happier writing comedy scripts than she was at her current job. So they were kind of getting into a deep conversation about what they really wanted from life. Things were settling down from the party atmosphere to more connecting and talking. So it was 1:30 when they left Bar Etiquette, and Tom Wright made offers to share a taxi with Jill or to walk her to her apartment, but she declined. She was only actually 800 meters from her building, and she'd walked that path many times before.
800 meters, half a mile.
Very close. Well, plus it's very well lit and heavily populated there. Even at 1:30 a.m., it's lively and social. In 2.5 minutes of CCTV footage, 13 taxis drove by, as well as several cars. So walking home wasn't particularly risky. In fact, she was so close that taxi drivers may have turned her down because it would be such a small fare. She was a bit tipsy, but not drunk. Also, the police station was only a few meters down the road. But of course, Jill has no way of knowing that she was going to cross paths with Adrian Bailey. But a lot of Bailey's evening was also captured on CCTV. He finished work at 5:41 and went and took some cash out at a local ATM. He was wearing tracksuit pants and sneakers with a gray beanie. He was also wearing his blue hoodie sweatshirt. He attended a work function that night at the Quiet Man Hotel. He walked into the venue at 7:28 with his then-girlfriend. He had changed clothes and was wearing a pair of jeans and a gray long-sleeve shirt. He'd also changed into some white, pointy dress shoes. Bailey spent the next couple of hours drinking beer there, and around 10 p.m., CCTV footage showed him exiting the bar with his girlfriend and a co-worker. Minutes later, the three of them were at another bar. Bailey was seen arguing with his girlfriend over some jealousy issues. He made a comment about her talking to other guys, and his co-worker left in a taxi. At that point, his girlfriend said she was going to the toilet, but she left the venue out the back door, and she took a taxi back to their apartment, where she told her landlady that she was hiding from Bailey. And from that point on, she ignored all of his texts and calls. It took a while for Bailey to realize that his girlfriend had ditched him, and at 12:24 a.m., he's caught on camera strutting around and trying to reach her on his cell phone, probably angry from the looks of it. And it's believed that he then took a taxi back to the apartment, but his girlfriend had gone out again, so she wasn't there. And this is when he changed back into his blue hoodie. According to Bailey, he tried to take a taxi back to pick up his car, but more likely he decided to go out and find a woman to assault. According to his story, he was kicked out of a taxi somewhere along Sydney Road because the driver thought he was too drunk and might vomit inside the car. This area had many venues, and Bailey would have known that young women would be heading home around that time of night.
Sure, good hunting grounds.
Absolutely.
So just after 1:30 in the morning that Saturday, the 22nd, CCTV footage from the storefronts and businesses along Sydney Road in Brunswick showed Jill walking along in her heels, slightly wobbly, but making steady progress. Once she reached the busy Zagami's Hotel, she crossed Sydney Road after waiting for a few cars to pass by. Now, during these last few minutes of her life, Jill used her mobile phone to call her brother in Perth. There was a three-hour time difference, so it was only 10:30 in Western Australia. This connection was bad, though, so Jill hung up to wait for her brother to call her back. Now, despite the poor reception, when he did call her back, her brother Michael would say he could hear a male voice in the background. But this is thought to be before Bailey approached Jill. At the time, Michael had no real concern about his sister's safety. She didn't sound frightened, just sad.
Yeah, then soon a large, solid-looking man in a blue hoodie can be seen on the CCTV footage lurking in the background. He seemed very energetic and hyper for so late at night. And Jill seemed to have no idea that she was being watched by Bailey, a predator who'd spent 11 years in jail for sexual assaults and rapes of 8 different women. Now he's out on bail and on parole. To add to that, he was very wound up after a night of drinking and fighting with his girlfriend, so it seems he was clearly looking for his next victim. Contrary to later accounts by Bailey, he had started watching Jill from a few blocks back. Two drivers passing by had seen him on the other side of the street and emerging from the darkness behind Jill. CCTV at Crust Gourmet Pizza Bar caught Jill walking by at 1:36 p.m. 30 seconds later, Bailey was seen by the same camera as he breaks into a run to catch up to her. Jill was then seen walking by a real estate office, and Bailey was caught by the same camera, now only a few steps behind her and walking in some very long strides. Bailey was an experienced predator, we know, and he avoided Jill's immediate suspicion by slowing to a walk and then walking past her before approaching her outside of a wedding dress shop. So from the start, the wedding dress shop footage showed Jill looking uncomfortable, hesitant, probably unnerved. This footage is partially obscured by the shop window display, but Jill's body language showed that she was getting worried. Bailey actually bounded up to her and said something to her, and when he speaks, Jill is seen turning and glancing behind her, as if she's looking for something or someone. And some people have suggested that Bailey was acting like he was saving her from someone stalking her from behind, and maybe he was encouraging her to follow him. He was known to try and act like he was a good Samaritan to get people to trust him, to get his victims to trust him. Jill had her phone in her hand, but she didn't try to call for help at that point, and she didn't call out to any passersby either and ask for help. He had said something to make her question whether or not she was in danger from him, I would guess. But it was only when he had taken her away from the public view that she would have realized what a monster he really was and what real trouble she was in.
So Jill's husband, Tom, sent her a text at 1:37 in the morning, asking her if she was okay. Now, she was either at that time preparing to answer that text or waiting for the phone to ring from her brother's return call, as she moved slowly from the CCTV footage and was never seen again. Her brother, Michael, tried to call Jill back 3 times with no answer. Tom texted again at 1:47. He texted, "Answer me, I'm really worried." He texted again at 2:07, 3:40, and 4:57 with no response. Then at 5 in the morning, Tom began searching the streets and was retracing her probable path down Sydney Road. He began texting her friends and work colleagues. He messaged Jill's friend Skye, who had left the office with her that Friday afternoon, and Skye was immediately worried.
Tom called the police to report Jill missing that morning. Although not returning home was totally out of character for her, police did not initially believe that she'd met with foul play. The search began that afternoon, with just a few police officers talking to local bar owners in the neighborhood. When they checked the nearby hospitals, they found nothing, and then they began talking to neighbors and the people she'd been out with Friday night. So in the days that followed, experienced investigators would criticize the initial search for Jill as way too low-key. After 2 days, police were really worried that she had been abducted or killed. But of course, at that point, it's too late. On Sunday, the 23rd of September, attention centered on laneways or alleys in the area. The alley off Hope Street was searched and an ABC marked pencil was found. It had fallen out of Jill's purse when she was being attacked. Later, after police had already searched that alley, her purse was found there. So what it turned out to be is that a local man had found the purse and taken it into his shop. But when he heard about Jill's disappearance, he didn't want to be involved in that, and he put it back where he'd found it. So they had to investigate him, of course, but he had nothing to do with her disappearance. It was very worrisome, of course, because Jill's purse had her IDs and her credit cards, and if she had gone off on her own, she wouldn't have left these things behind, clearly. So police knew that something bad had probably happened to her at that point. The story of Jill's disappearance quickly became the lead story on the local news on that Sunday night. Police referred the case to Crew 4, which is a highly specialized, suspicious missing persons unit. So this group is usually called in when police suspect the missing person case is actually going to turn out to be a homicide case. Homicide detectives took note that Hope Street was a location where an assault could occur on scene. Once Jill was moved off from Sydney Road, she could be in a deserted area. And there were some residents in the area, but the lighting there was very poor.
Abductions by a stranger off the street are very rare. The perpetrator would probably need a car to get away from the scene with Jill. They contacted the local businesses for their CCTV coverage. And as we all know, statistically, Tom Maher would be the most likely suspect in his wife's disappearance. So he was investigated heavily before he was ruled out as a suspect. Tom seemed to be very genuinely disturbed and devastated that she was missing. He was interviewed by detectives for hours, and he gave honest answers. The mystery grew as Jill's family and friends used Twitter and Facebook to get the word out about her disappearance. A Facebook group titled Help Us Find Jill Maher received over 300,000 likes.
Bailey had brutally assaulted, raped, and murdered Jill in the alley that night. Then he worked at getting away with it. He couldn't leave her body in the alley because he knew his DNA was there. So he returned to his apartment and changed his clothing. Then he took a shovel and his girlfriend's white car and went back to the crime scene. CCTV footage from a local business showed the white car turning into the alley off Hope Street at 4:22 a.m. He took her phone but left her purse, and the footage showed the car leaving the lane at about 4:26 a.m. After Bailey buried Jill's body in a shallow grave, he drove back toward his apartment, but he ran out of gas on the way. A local man was flagged down by Bailey at about 6 a.m., and this man drove him to a service station, where he was seen again on CCTV buying a gas can and gas. He arrived back at his apartment at about 6:30 and smashed Jill's phone in his own driveway. Then he put her damaged SIM card in his pants pocket. His girlfriend would say that she heard him come in around 7 a.m. He told her he'd taken a shower, and he was very apologetic about their argument the night before. The girlfriend did notice a large bruise across the bridge of his nose, and he explained it by saying he'd gotten into a fight with a couple of guys when he was out looking for her, kind of making himself a martyr, like he was defending her honor or looking for her, you know?
Yeah, scumbag.
Now, Bailey and his girlfriend slept until early that afternoon, and they drove back to where he had parked his car, and he drove it back to the apartment. On the way back, they picked up some food and rented some movies. At about 10 p.m. that Saturday night, he was filmed on CCTV at a self-service car wash, vacuuming and cleaning the white car. Now, the next day, he spent more time cleaning that car. He was known to wash and detail their cars often, but that weekend he was noted to be extremely meticulous.
Then on Monday, Bailey showed up early for his work, but left sick. He told co-workers that he got the bruise across his nose by fighting off a gang. Story gets better.
Yeah.
So he left work sick, then he went and had the tires on his car changed. This was again caught on CCTV. And that afternoon, he filled out the paperwork to have ownership of the car transferred to his girlfriend's name. So he's busy covering his tracks, isn't he?
Yeah, he definitely is trying to cover his tracks. But as police watched the CCTV footage from the night of Jill's disappearance, the man in the blue hoodie quickly became their suspect. So they decided to show the footage to the public to help identify him. At this point, investigators were almost certain that Jill had been killed, and they were worried that her killer was going to strike again. On that Tuesday, the footage played on the nightly news. The footage of Bailey approaching Jill is quite ominous to watch. Now they knew that Tom Marr was innocent, and Jill never made it home that night. Police put out a request for the man in the footage to come forward and speak with them, and they also put out a public appeal if anyone could help identify who it was. Police heard from a local man who had walked past Bailey and Jill on Sydney Road that night. But nothing about Bailey had caught his attention, and he couldn't identify his face. Now, this guy had stopped ahead of them at a kebab shop and watched people walk by for about 10 minutes after he passed them. So he was sure he never saw Jill pass the shop. This is what helped police to confirm that Jill never made it past Hope Street. The site of her disappearance was now narrowed down to quite a small area.
Yeah, and time passes, and the man in the blue hoodie didn't surface. But he became more and more suspicious, because there's no other viable suspects.
Right, so, and if you saw yourself in that footage and you were innocent, you'd call police right away.
One would think, right?
Right.
So the footage and Jill's story were all over the radio, TV, and newspapers. Now, Bailey himself never called Crime Stoppers, but over 500 people did. Now, Bailey had made a huge mistake when he took Jill's cell phone in the car with him when he went to hide her body, because police technicians were able to track the path that the phone's SIM card had taken as it pinged on several different towers. So the movement of Jill's cell phone showed that it had been in the Brunswick area until about 4:30 in the morning, which was the same time when Bailey had driven off Hope Street with her body in the trunk. So investigators were able to track the movement out into the country. Next, they needed to identify the car the phone had been traveling in. So one of the cars recorded traveling that path was the white car registered to Adrian Bailey. When they did a criminal background check, they saw all of his previous convictions for violent, sexually deviant crimes going back 22 years.
Yeah, that's over half his life. So when they got access to Bailey's phone records, its movements directly matched Jill's phone movements. So each of their cell tower pings were identical. So of course at this point, Bailey's their person of interest. Police spoke to his girlfriend, who did identify him in the footage. Things were beginning to add up in her mind. She told the investigators about a SIM card that she had found in their laundry. So she turned that in, and it was confirmed to be registered to Jill Marr. While executing a search warrant of Bailey's apartment, Police found pieces of Jill's smashed cell phone, along with some of her clothing that she'd been wearing on the night she disappeared. They also seized the shovel and the clothing Bailey had worn that night. Now, I don't know if this was something he was doing to collect a souvenir, why he had some of her clothing. I find that strange, because it seemed like he was dumping everything else.
Well, and even finding pieces of her cell phone.
Yeah, smashing it at his house was...
Yeah, and not cleaning it up.
No, but nobody said he was smart, did they?
Apparently not.
No. Well, a phone call was placed to Bailey's workplace, and he was asked to come home. And when asked if this had something to do with the previous Friday night and the bruise across his nose, he told his co-workers that it probably was related to that. Now, he was taken into custody that afternoon when he got home and taken in for questioning. As he had with his previous crimes, he denied having anything to do with Jill's disappearance at first. When he was confronted with the overwhelming amount of evidence, however, he made up a story about how Jill was nasty to him. He said he had no intention to kill her, but he was trying to help her. But then she flipped him off and he lost his temper with her. He even put part of the blame on the fight he'd had earlier with his girlfriend and on his drinking. He even shed some tears. Clearly not for Jill, though, but for what he was going through. On Thursday, September 27th, Bailey took police to where he had buried Jill's body. Up until his arrest, Jill's family, of course, was holding out hope that she would be found alive. So the news that she had been killed was obviously heartbreaking. Bailey's arrest and the finding of Jill's body generated considerable media and public response, especially when it was soon revealed that Bailey was already on parole and for the series of sexual offenses that he had been imprisoned for. There was a 2-day committal case in the Melbourne Magistrates Court that was scheduled to begin on March 12th of 2013. And according to news reports at the time, Bailey intended to fight these charges. On the 5th of April, he pled guilty to the rape and the murder. And on the 26th, he pled not guilty to several other sexual assaults in Melbourne, dating back to 2000.
But he did confess to Jill Maher's abduction and murder.
Yep, he did. So Bailey appeared in court in June 2013 for a pre-sentencing hearing. Victim impact statements from the Mara family, Jill's friend Effie Lyons, and her former supervisor at the ABC, Catherine Hurley, were read. Catherine's statement actually revealed that many of Jill's ABC colleagues had sought counseling from the ABC's employee assistance program just because they had such a hard time dealing with Jill's death. On the date of the pre-sentencing hearing, a suppression order was also lifted, which allowed Bailey's extensive history of rape and violence to finally be revealed.
And then on the 19th of June in 2013, in front of a packed public gallery at the Victorian Supreme Court, Bailey was sentenced to life imprisonment with a non-parole period of 35 years. Outside the court, George McKeon, surrounded by the rest of Jill's family and supporters, announced that justice had been done.
Well, I mean, I guess it had in theory, but a non-parole period of 35 years is not great.
No.
He didn't get life without parole, and that just seems to be something they just didn't do. It just wasn't done,
yeah,
I guess.
I mean, there's just such a difference in the justice system. If this had been in the United States, if it was in the wrong state, he would have been sentenced to death.
Absolutely. I think it would have been a death penalty case. Yeah. But even if it wasn't that, I think he would have gotten life.
He would have gotten life without parole, yeah.
Well, not to be totally pro-American, but I also don't think he would have been out if he was in the U.S.
He wouldn't have been.
I mean, we certainly have our problems here, but I don't think he would have been free.
And then in September of 2013, Bailey filed an appeal against his sentence through Victorian Legal Aid. The appeal argued that the minimum sentence was too long, and that he had not taken perverted pleasure in murdering Jill, as stated by the sentencing judge. This appeal was dismissed.
Well, by March of 2015, he'd been found guilty of 3 more rapes, of course, that were committed before he killed Jill, and he had 3 separate trials that were held in 2014 and 2015. These victims, 2 sex workers and a Dutch backpacker, came forward due to the high level of publicity over Jill's rape and murder. By then, he'd been convicted of sexual crimes against 12 people. and later in May 2015, he was sentenced to another 18 years, which brought his non-parole period up from 35 to 43 years.
Still amazed.
Yeah, I mean, by then, though, he'll be a very old man.
Yeah, but if he's got this 35-year sentence and then they find three other people testifying against him, they only increase his sentence to 43 years?
Right. Well, I mean, they gave him another 18 years, but the non-parole period was only extended by another 8 years.
Right.
Well, yeah, I'm not saying it's great.
So in June 2015, Bailey lodged an appeal against two of the three convictions and the extended non-parole period. This appeal was also thrown out.
Well, he made another appeal in July of 2016 against one rape conviction, and he was given a 3-year reduction to his sentence. That made him eligible for parole in 2055, and at that point he would be 83 years old. Bailey's lawyer told the court that his client had been diagnosed with borderline personality disorder and alcohol dependence. It was also said that he'd been physically abused by his father and sexually abused by an older female relative. I mean, I think that if that happened to him, that's sad, but many people have been abused in their childhood and don't do these things, so I really think it's irrelevant.
It is. I mean, it might explain why he acted like he did, but...
It might explain some of it, yeah.
But it doesn't make any difference in the long run.
No, it doesn't excuse it in any way, and it doesn't give us any reason to want him out sooner, for sure.
That's right. So by late June 2013, there had been changes in Victoria's parole laws. And these changes came about as the direct result of women like Jill being attacked and killed by parolees. So, for example, if parole is breached, then penalties of up to 3 months imprisonment and a fine of up to $4,200 can result. And police can now formally act if a parolee breaches parole, and violent offenders would automatically go back to prison if the breach was a serious one.
I would argue that violent offenders should automatically go back no matter what it is.
Yeah.
You know?
If you jaywalk.
Absolutely. So the then Premier of Victoria, Dennis Napthine, commented in June 2013, "There is no doubt the system failed Jill Maher. Under the changes we've already introduced, the offender would have been back in jail, not on the streets. Our actions are the minimum we can do to try and make sure this never happens again." I would agree. That's the minimum.
Yes.
In August 2013, former High Court Justice Ian Callanan recommended 23 more changes to the Victorian parole system. He recommended that a full-time parole board be created because they actually only had a part-time one at that time, and that prisoners should have to prove that they were low-risk offenders before being granted parole. To me, that should just be obvious. That's the way it should be.
Yeah, I mean, to me, again...
If you're not low-risk, why are you given that opportunity?
That's a no-brainer.
I think so. An electronic database, he also said, should replace the paper filing system that they were currently using.
Another no-brainer.
Yeah.
So Jill's widower, Tom, left Melbourne and returned to his hometown in Ireland in 2013. He returned briefly to Australia in November 2014 to promote the White Ribbon Movement, and this was a campaign to stop violence against women. In an interview around this time, he said that since his wife's death, he reads daily from the writings of Maya Angelou. He wrote an essay on the White Ribbon website, "The Danger of the Monster Myth," about public stereotypes of rapists. So there were other Irish deaths in Melbourne around the time of Jill's murder. 30-year-old David Green and 64-year-old Dermot O'Toole. Interestingly, each of their murderers were also people out on parole when they committed these crimes.
Well, and each of them had several convictions in their past.
Yeah.
One was
even more prolific than Bailey.
Yes. Well, Dermot O'Toole, he was a 64-year-old jewelry shop owner, and he and his wife were attacked with a knife by a guy who'd had over 200 past convictions.
Right.
And he was killed. And then David Green, the man who killed him, also attacked another man and had had over 50 convictions and was out on parole. So Jill wasn't the only one who was a victim of this system. and was let down by the Australian justice system.
No, unfortunately.
So there have been more improvements, but Dermot O'Toole's family is still very active in trying to get changes into the system that would prevent these parolees from reoffending, and to just make it more difficult to get parole in the first place. It should be more of a privilege than something that's owed to you as a convict.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that a long time ago.
Yeah.
That parole is a privilege to be earned. And not something that's automatically granted you.
Yeah, but for years, at least in Australia, it was treated as something that you just get automatically.
Yeah. And you serve your time and you get out on parole.
Right. So what a fascinating case. I just want to thank Lisa one more time. She gave me the book, Evil in a Blue Hoodie, written by Joe St. John, which is where I initially learned about this case. There's other media on the case. There's a great documentary called Evil in the Night, an Australia real crime documentary you can find on YouTube. And there's a documentary called Murder in Melbourne, the murders of Jill Maher, Dermot O'Toole, and David Green. So before we get to our listener feedback, I just want to give a thank you to our listeners. We really missed everybody last week.
I felt like something was missing.
I'd also like to thank our TIEGrabber members and our Patreon supporters and everyone who's taken the time to write to us and leave us voicemails. If you have feedback or a crime you'd like to suggest, please email us, direct message us, or leave us a voicemail. We had a little burst of voicemails when I asked for them, and now it's kind of fallen off. So if you have an idea for a voicemail, we'd love to get it. You can just click on Leave Us a Voicemail on our website, TIEGrabber.com, and I actually upgraded our widget there, so there's a 3-minute minimum, so you can talk for 3 minutes before you'll get cut off. So I think that's a pretty good amount of time to leave a voicemail. 3 minutes, you can usually get in what you want to say.
I would think.
Yeah.
I could do it in about 30 seconds.
Well, you're very succinct, right?
Right.
But also, if you'd like to email it to us, if you're a little too shy, you can email to truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com. Now, if listening to True Crime Brewery is a positive part of your life, if you missed us last week and you enjoy an extra episode to fill in the blanks here and there, you can offer us support by joining Team TIEGrabber at our website, TIEGrabber.com, or by becoming a patron at patreon.com/truecrimebrewery. As a member, you'll get access to about 20 members-only TCB episodes and all of the new ones that we release once a month. These are full-length episodes that we put just as much effort into as our regular episodes. Now, when you join, you're helping to pay for the costs of producing and distributing the show. Plus, we're going to send you some gifts. And after you sign up, please check your junk mail if you don't hear from us right away, because sometimes that's where your instructions might end up. These are automated emails, and sometimes that happens. There are other ways to offer us some support as well. You can support us by following us on Twitter, at TIEGrabber Pods, on Instagram, or on Facebook. You can also participate on Facebook in our True Crime Brewery Fan Discussions page, which is a private group that you can join, and you can talk to us about crimes, and all your other friends don't have to hear, you know, what a true crime freak you really are. Also, if you take a few minutes to leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to our podcast, that would help us out a lot. So on to feedback.
Okay, we got a couple of voicemails. So the first one is from Kristen S. with a case suggestion.
Okay, so let's listen to that.
Hey guys, my name is Kristen, and I just wanted to let you guys know that I'm really enjoying this podcast. I found y'all about 2 months ago, and I've been binging ever since, and I really appreciate all of the effort and time that you put into your cases. And I also have a case that happened in my hometown that predates the internet, so there's not a lot of information out there, but I have done a little research myself, and the victim's name was David McLean, and he was killed by three teens. The first boy was named Joshua Halbert, H-A-L-B-E-R-T, and the second boy was John Nickpour, N-I-C-H-Y-P-O-U-R, and Kevin Pierce. And on the 20th of September 1988, these three teens went to David McLean's house to good idea to kill him. And they beat him with a baseball bat, they cut his throat, they stabbed him, they beat him, they did, you know, all kinds of mean, nasty stuff to him. And the reason that I'm finding this case so interesting is because I believe it was in 2011, the Supreme Court had decided that anyone under 18 in the United States who was convicted of first-degree murder and given a life sentence, that that life sentence would not be upheld and they could apply for parole. And that brings up a whole other can of worms, and I was wondering what you two thought of it.
Okay, so this was kind of a disturbing case.
Yeah, thanks for calling in, Kristen.
So David McLean was killed by three teenage boys, Joshua Halbert, John Nick Kapoor, and Kevin Pierce. This occurred in Gloucester, Massachusetts. The three boys had gone to McLean's house to party with him, which was going to involve drugs and drinking and getting high.
Yeah,
and
what
they
else?
They ended up killing him because McLean was a known homosexual.
Yeah, so this was actually a hate crime.
It was.
Yeah.
So the boys were tried separately, convicted of first-degree murder, and sentenced to life in prison. Then in December of 2013, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court found life sentences without parole are unconstitutional for killers under the age of 18, saying such sentences amounted to cruel and unusual punishment and failed to take into account their youth and ability to recognize the consequences. So this was, as you might imagine, a highly controversial decision. And eventually it was amended by the legislature to a 25-year minimum. So these guys were convicted in 1988, so they got in under the 2013 ruling. The three boys, who are actually now middle-aged men, they're in their 40s, have all applied and lost their first bids for parole.
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about this, Dick. I mean, I do think they were young, and should they give up their entire life? I don't know. I mean, it was a brutal crime, and David McLean lost his whole life. So, I mean, I could go back and forth on that.
Yeah, well, and the other thing is that the age was kind of arbitrarily set at age 18. These guys were 17. And I would submit that a 17-year-old might have more culpability than a 13-year-old, say.
Well, that's where we get back to the whole not trying them as an adult.
Right.
Right.
So they picked a number, basically.
Yeah, and what else are you going to do, though?
I know.
Right? You kind of have to.
Yeah.
Okay. Then we have a voicemail from Natalie.
Hi, this is Natalie from Hattiesburg. I just wanted to thank y'all for reading my feedback on the Dog Mullen case. True Crime Brewery is my absolute favorite show. In between new episodes, I've been rewatching some of the older ones. I hadn't watched the Georgia 10 episode until this week, but I thoroughly enjoyed learning more about her. In regards to the Tracy Richter and Michelle Yelenic cases, I enjoyed them in a way where you can love to hate something because these true human vampires who consumed others for their own gain. My uncle's life was destroyed by someone like this by being driven to suicide. Similarly, my uncle's wife pounced on him. She played the victim. She isolated him from his loved ones, cheated on him with his friend, and used him up. Now, of course, it was his decision to take his own life, but one has to look at what brought him to that. People who have issues with everyone they meet, the ones who claim someone is always out to get them, latch onto a healthy host to devour. These two cases just resonated with me. Thank you guys for being so awesome. Keep up the good work. Thanks.
Thanks, Natalie. So, what do you think about this? I mean, Tracy Richter was brutal. Michelle Yelenic, brutal woman. And I think that people like that really do kind of, you know, go after the nice person they can take advantage of, that they can do whatever they want to do to.
Yeah, I think what they do is kind of target somebody because they know that they'll be able to exert their influence.
And the people that they take advantage of do seem like very kind-hearted people that are easy to manipulate.
Exactly.
So I'm very sorry about your uncle. I think that's tragic.
Oh, horrible.
Yeah. And then we have a few emails.
We do. We have three of them to discuss.
So the first one is from Maya. It's a case suggestion. Maya says, "Hi, once again, I love your podcast. I would like you to look at the case of TV host Louis Vigoro. He was very well known and loved in Puerto Rico and was ordered assassinated by his wife, Lydia Echevarria, who was also very well known in the 1980s. He was kidnapped and burned in the trunk of his Mercedes. She was eventually convicted and sentenced to 208 years in prison." Now there's a sentence.
Yeah. See, Puerto Rico doesn't fuck around, do they?
No. So Louis Vigoro Rivera, born April 12, 2028, and died January 1983, was a Puerto Rican radio and television show host, announcer, comedian, and producer. He was considered a pioneer in the television business in Puerto Rico, and he enjoyed success with several radio and television shows throughout his career. So he was brutally murdered on January 17, 1983, and his wife was convicted in 1986 of planning the murder, along with hitmen Papo Newman and David Lopez Watts. So on the morning of January 18, 1983, Vigoro didn't show up to work at the radio station or at WAPA-TV, and that caused his co-workers to worry. When his Mercedes was found with a burned body inside, it was taken to the medical examiner's office, where it was confirmed that it was him. His death launched a wave of rumors and speculations and led to one of the biggest trials in Puerto Rico's history. Now, his wife, Lydia, was accused formally of the murder, along with Papo Newman and David Lopez Watts. Allegedly, Lydia had become jealous of a relationship Vigoro started having with actress Nidia Castillo, and had paid Newman and Lopez Watts to either beat him or murder him. Vigoro's body was found gagged, stabbed, and burned inside the car's trunk. Lydia has maintained her innocence, but she was convicted to a life sentence in Puerto Rico. Newman and Lopez Watts received similar sentences. However, Lydia and Lopez Watts only served about 12 years in jail. In January 2000, Governor Pedro Roselló granted Lydia a pardon, which was largely criticized by the people. At the time of his death, Vigoro was about to begin another game show, A Million, which eventually became one of the most popular shows in Puerto Rican television history, under the hosting of Hector Marcano and produced by Vigoro's son, Luisito Vigoro. So I like the sounds of this case. I think I would like to cover that. I know there's not a huge amount of information out there, but it's juicy.
It is. I like the sense that it's a Puerto Rican crime. We haven't done any of those yet. To me, that'd be an interesting case to do. And the other thing that would be interesting to me is that huge sentence reduced to 12 years. I'd like to know what was going on with that.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to find out how that happened.
Yeah.
So yeah, we should definitely look into that one. So thank you, Maya.
Let's do that. Then we have an email from Lisa B. with a case suggestion. Lisa B. says, "I'm so thankful to have found your podcast on Stitcher. Love it. I'm a nuclear pharmaceutical courier. Love my job, but sometimes the long hours behind the wheel are quite boring, and your podcast makes driving 10 hours a day bearable. I do want to suggest a case out of Missouri from 1992, where a wrongly convicted man served a 16-year sentence and was later released due to a new sheriff reopening the closed case. 19-year-old Michelle Lawless was beaten and shot 3 times in her car. Lots of twists and turns in the story. Think you guys would enjoy this case. Thanks for all the great laughs along the way in your stories you share on cases. I'll tune in next time at the Quiet End." So just a little very quick synopsis. In November 1992, Rick Walter, who was at that time a part-time deputy and is now sheriff, discovered the body of nursing student Michelle Lawless in her car on a Missouri highway off-ramp. Michelle had been shot and brutally beaten. Now, Joshua Keyser was convicted of her murder in 2003. Then in 2006, the new sheriff, Rick Walter, reopened the case because he believed Keyser had been wrongfully convicted. Walter felt that a number of leads in the case had never been followed up on. And a result of this reopening the case, Keyser was released from prison in 2009. So as Lisa suggests, or as Lisa stated, he served 16 years for a wrongful conviction. Now, at this point, the case does remain open, and new leads are continuing to emerge. They've even exhumed Michelle's body, hopefully to obtain some DNA evidence. We shall see. I think this would be something interesting to look up.
We'll see. One thing I really like to do is I'd like to do more false confessions, wrongful convictions, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you, Lisa.
All right, one more.
Yep, Susanna E. has a case suggestion. Hi, Jill and Dick. I love TCB and look forward to seeing the episode drop every week. The way you handle cases is always in-depth but sensitive to the victim. I have a case suggestion for you from the UK. I know you have said it's hard doing cases that involve children, but this one, the victim was found alive and well. It's the case of the kidnap of Shannon Matthews. On February 19, 2008, 9-year-old Shannon Matthews was reported missing by her distraught mother, Karen. What unraveled over the next couple of weeks was a nationwide hunt of the missing girl. It is a case that was compared to the disappearance of Madeline McCann. The search went on for nearly a month with public pleas from her mother to bring the girl home. Then, on the 14th of March, good news, Shannon had been found alive. The kidnappers were arrested and charged over the next couple of weeks, including her own mother. The case involved neglect, fraud to get reward money, and what would drive a mother to do that to their own child. There is also the effect the case had on the people surrounding the case. The deception on all those who supported Karen while she was a worried mother, in particular on one friend. I think this would be a good case for a discussion at the quiet end. If Dickie needs a beer selection for a good Yorkshire beer, it would be Black Sheep Brewery.
Baba.
Now, I do like the idea of doing one with a happy ending. That's a great idea.
Well, everybody we talk about is dead.
Yes.
So this would be fun.
It would be a lot better. So let's do that for sure.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Susanna. Great suggestion.
Wonderful. Thanks.
And thanks, everybody, for the suggestions. We really do enjoy it. I can't encourage it enough. If you would send us a voicemail or an email, we read them all, and we try and put most of them in an episode.
We do.
For the most part, yes.
Now, I've been a little lax lately.
We've been busy.
But that's my excuse.
Yes.
But I'm going to get caught up, and we'll have a new one come out in a week, and I'll have plenty of feedback.
Yeah, so if you sent a voicemail or an email a week or two ago and it hasn't been on an episode yet, do not despair, because it's probably a file somewhere on Dick's laptop, and it will come to the surface.
Promise. All right, guys, girls, thanks a lot.
Okay.
See you in a week.
We will see you in a week at the quiet end. Thank you for listening.
Bye.
Bye-bye.